Hey, good morning, everybody. So, little confession. Sometime after becoming a Christian, I discovered I had a condition that I think of as spiritual amnesia. Perhaps you can identify with this. I'd get up and I'd have a quiet time and I'd drive to work, sometimes listening to Christian music, and I'd go to work, and then I'd find myself leaving the office at the end of the day and realize that I'd totally forgotten I was a Christian the whole day. You know, it just sort of went out the window. And it bothered me, and I tried several things to fix it. Right? I could put Bible verses on my desk, even have a lunchtime Bible study. And while those things created a pocket of time where I kind of took my work hat off and put my Christian hat on, they were never on at the same time. And I find most people that take their faith seriously feel the same way. That they want to have, the challenge of being a Christian at work is trying to find a differentness, right? There ought to be something different about me in the way that I'm going about work, not just that sometimes I take a break and be a Christian and then go back to doing work stuff. and this challenge has interested me for many years now. So I have this deep sense that there should be this differentness. A lot of other people feel the same way. And it's how can you be authentically and noticeably Christian in a way that complements your work and working style instead of distracting it? Now, many of you, I think, are pastors or headed in the direction of being pastors, and these things, I think, also potentially apply to you. You know, you have an office place, and there's business that you're doing. There's things that you have to manage. But the other thing that I thought about as I was coming here is that I've had many pastors who remark to me that the sermons that they've given on workplace and in the workplace have been the most responded to. People sort of react to it and respond more than almost anything else they give, and which is kind of annoys them because it's not really their best stuff, right? They wish that wasn't true, but there's all this reaction. And so I think one of the things to think about is that there's this deep hunger for people, right? If you've embraced this, if you've sort of made this Christ-likeness at the core of your identity, then it ought to show up in every place. Right, and they're kind of looking for how does that happen in the workplace. Well, my quest for this book started with a pastor who at Crossroads who asked me to teach a Sunday school class on workplace evangelism. And I thought about it, and I came back and I declined. He says, "Well, why?" And I said, "Because nobody's taught the prerequisite workplace Christianity. I mean, how are you going to sort of say, you know, how are you going to sort of say do what I do when you're not doing anything?" Right, and so he basically shrugged and said, "We'll teach that then," and walked off. So, Pastor one, Chris zero. But but it kind of led me to this question of it's like, okay, I guess I have to accept. Now I really have to figure this out. And as I thought about, okay, how would I teach this? How would I sort of go through this? It really led me to a study of the fruit of the Spirit. You know what the fruit of the Spirit is. I don't have to go through a lot of it, but it's a set of nine virtues that are found in Galatians. And the qualities that Paul lists, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, are things that are, if practiced artfully in the workplace, they're not only welcome there, but highly prized when practiced skillfully. And so they are the attitudes and habits that reflect the personality of Christ, right? So as I kind of looked at it, I thought, okay, if I asked somebody, if I had the opportunity to ask somebody who traveled with Jesus for a number of years and said, what was he like? I feel like almost anything that somebody would tell me, I could fall into love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. I could categorize it into one of those things. And so if my goal as a believer is to conform to the image of Christ, if I want to look like him, there's one of the best ways I feel like I can do is to learn how to artfully practice these fruit, right? To have them be if those are extension of me, then I must be looking like Jesus. So in my book, what I tried to do is develop a very practical definition for each fruit and to flesh out what it might look like to express these things in the workplace. So, you know, just to kind of to show example of this. So love. Right, and this is an agape love, right? So it's a commitment to others, freely given, without counting the cost or measuring how it might benefit you. And so it's rooted. We know how to practice it because it's rooted in the love that God showed us. And at work, it's this kind of consistent love towards others, not with an agenda. And if you do that right, you wind up, you know, it's the right thing to do, but it has these other effects because, and I'll talk about trust in a little bit. Trust is, there's actually almost a whole economics of trust. Trust is within the workplace and within relationships, the way that you get things done, the way that you change things that need changing. And it turns out that people trust the people who love them the most, right? Showing love to people naturally generates the trust that you may need in order to be able to get things done, solve problems, and fix relationships. And so being able, making a habit out of that love gives you tools in any workplace that turn out to be quite valuable. Joy is this kind of delight of the mind, right? Happiness is something that you experience. Joy is more like a possession, right? You can always reach back and grab that thing. And there are times in work and in any situation where you have a setback, where something feels really dark. It's tough to imagine it being brighter again. I think about, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy when things are going really hard for Sam and Frodo, and Sam is trying to remind Frodo of the Shire and the taste of strawberries, and Frodo can't even remember what strawberries taste like because it's so dark to him. And so this notion of being able to have this joy that is always accessible to you as a Christian and be able to reach out and be able to take hold of that allows you to be the first one within your team that snaps out of it, right? So it's valuable, but it also has practical application. You know, peace is a contentment, a well-being rooted in our reconciliation with God through Christ. But at work, it kind of gives you a steady hand under pressure, right? You're not rattled easily. That you have the spiritual security that allows you to put your day-to-day demands in perspective. Patience is, it's kind of like junior varsity grace, right? It's choosing not to be annoyed at the person who leaves the photocopier on legal instead of letter or forgets to turn the coffee machine on. And all these other things that, you know, when you have a group that's working together and they start getting annoyed with each other, it's like gears that when there's no oil greasing the gears. Right? Just these petty annoyances all of a sudden start to blossom into things that keep people from being able to do important things together. And so being able to cultivate this notion of patience, this ability to say, I've been forgiven for much more than leaving the coffee maker on, I can deal with that, is important in all environments, but in the workplace. Kindness is, and it's interesting, within this fruit of the Spirit, there's kind of a set of attitudes. There's things that go on in your heart, and then there's the expression of them, right? So love, joy, peace, and patience are largely what's going on inside your heart, how you're reflecting on it. Kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control are actually sort of visible externally, right? They're kind of more the practice of the first four. So kindness is that active love, right? It's the visible demonstration of your feeling towards them. Goodness is actively choosing the following of moral good. Faithfulness is the practice of holding fast to what you know to be true in the face of doubts and questions. And you know, gentleness is this restraint that allows you to be accessible as a boss and approachable and not intimidating, which if you don't practice it, you don't wind up hearing the things that are going wrong in your company because they're afraid you're going to take it out on them. Right, so cultivating this gentleness turns out to be a very valuable tool. Self-control or acts of goodness. It's the self-discipline that can to consistently demonstrate this fruit of the Spirit, that's sort of rooted in the daily habits. You know, this notion of daily sort of reflecting on where did I miss the opportunities that you gave me, God? How do I do better tomorrow? Constantly trying to conform yourself. Is this day-to-day discipline that results in hopefully self-control, that you're able to reel yourself in the right times. So all of these things are, all these things, really what the book does is it takes each of those pieces and I put a little theological scaffolding on it, and then I just put some anecdotes and other things around it to sort of say, okay, this is what it looks like. So when I taught the class, I kind of expected, I mean, a lot of times as an entrepreneur, I'm talking to a lot of sort of management and CEOs and things like that. And the class that God gave me was interesting. There was a car dealer, there was a woman who taught at a lunch counter who served at a lunch counter downtown, a couple of like government bureaucrats, a bunch of other people. And But the reactions when we came in, we kind of talked about what patients looked like, and they came in the next week and sort of talked about, you know, I practiced, this thing came up and I practiced patients, and this thing happened different than happened last week when I didn't. And everyone had a different story. And there was a woman who came up to me and said, you know, she worked in the Department of Housing for the state. She says, you know, that I feel like I've gone to Christian bookstores for years looking for something to help me bring my faith into the workplace, and every book I find was written for my boss, not me. And she says, this is the first time I've had something that sort of practically shows me what I can be doing. And that was a real, I mean, you know, I was really, it was terrific that I kind of had this broad base to be able to see it. And it was at that point that I kind of took the bigger step of saying, okay, maybe this needs to be more than this class, and let's make a book out of it. So it wasn't something I'd set out to do that way. In fact, I was hoping somebody had already written this. I mean, the fruit and work had been around for thousands of years. I mean, somebody should have done this by now. But if it's out there, I didn't find it, and so I had to put it together. But it's simple, but I tried to keep it kind of applicable pretty broadly. So as I've tried to practice this fruit, I've basically found a few things that came out of it. First of all, what it does is it kind of aligns my spiritual growth with my professional growth, right? And anyone that has a job, they're trying to figure out how to build their brand, right? What color are they going to paint their parachute? If, you know, that book I think is still being reprinted, but how are people going to know me in the office? What am I going to be known for? And if it turns out that the brand that I'm building is the brand of the fruit of the Spirit, then there's this really virtuous cycle that goes on, right? If my brand was being great at taking people out to golf and closing them on deals, I'd be spending a lot of time sort of golfing with other people and, you know, watching the Golf Channel, doing lots of other stuff, right? If I was a closer in sales, I would be, you know, trying to learn these things. But instead, if I'm building on it, it means that the more people recognize that, the more I want to be better at it, right? So my identity winds up conforming to this, what I'm projecting. And so the more I practice the fruit, it more becomes what I'm known for at work. The more important my fruit is at work, the more I want to grow spiritually in it. And it's also, I mean, funny things happen, because sometimes when I'm in the midst of a meeting and I'm sort of consciously saying, you know, this is a time to bring joy into this, this is a time to bring, you know, this is a time to exercise goodness, it kind of feels like worship. Right? There's sort of this moment where I've kind of invited God into this meeting, not in a way that necessarily the rest of the people around the table see visibly, but in a way where I feel like I'm doing the things that Jesus would have done had he been in that meeting. Right? And so ultimately there's this closeness to God that comes, like it comes upon you in worship from it. And I also do feel like I'm working in a way that's authentically Christian and welcome. One of the things that my journey to being a follower of Christ, I grew up in a Catholic family. I sort of understood, practically said the prayer every Sunday. I just didn't sort of have ears to hear it during that time. And then my younger sister went to App, and her roommate was the daughter of a minister. She by Easter break or by spring break, she was already, you know, both, you know, an evangelical and obnoxious about it, right? And sort of writing stuff on the fridge and sending notes and trying to sneak everything around. And so during that time, at that point I understood the gospel, right? I sort of, you know, four spiritual laws or whatever, I kind of saw the logic of it and what it was. But to me the question is, could I live like I believe that for the rest of my life? Because there's lots of things that sound compelling, right? Particularly to college students. They can read I read Ayn Rand in college, and that made a lot of sense to me. But then I noticed there's no children in Ayn Rand's books. This virtue of selflessness does not work very well when you have someone in diapers, right? So it's, you know, and you can be anarchist, and you can be, you know, socialism sounds like a great thing when you're not having a paycheck being deducted from. And so it really kind of came down to needing to see people that I felt were like me. And I felt like the kind of people that I wanted to be, that were living like they believed this. And at that time, I really didn't know many people like that. And God started sort of peppering me with these Christians. There were either employees of mine that I came to find were Christians and looked back and thought, oh, okay, that makes sense. I see how there's a consistency with how they're responding to me, where this is. Or their business, people I had business relationships with that I heard they were Christians when I started working with them and saw that difference. And that was really the thing that was key for me. Because at a certain point, when I knew that it was something that you could live, that you could live out, wasn't going to be easy, but it was doable. That I knew that it was time to really, commit my life and turn that corner. And so, to some degree within the workplace, I mean, there are opportunities where I can sort of speak frankly about the gospel and about God to people. But a lot of it for me is I'm known as a Christian, right? Writing this book puts it on my LinkedIn page. Everyone I do business with who pulls up sees, okay, he's done all these CEO things and started all these companies, and wait, he's written a Christian book about the workplace. What is that? I don't really have to, letting them know about it, they kind of know, but being consistent with it, sort of having it be good that they find out I'm a Christian, that's kind of the hard work. But this kind of pathway of sort of thinking through the fruit becomes a piece of that, right? So one of the things that kind of getting back to this notion of difference, right? What would it sound like for a Christian to be different in the workplace? Let me just kind of give you a few examples. So if you're practicing the fruit of love, you might overhear, out of everyone in the office, Holly was the only one, was the only one who remembered that today was the anniversary of the day I lost my mom. This is my mother-in-law's birthday. She died 23 years ago, and I just dropped in on her on the way here. So, sorry, you can edit that out, right? You make it sound like I'm cool. So, but anyway, this notion that you're still thinking about, that you thought to make that note, right? Joy, have you noticed how nothing really gets Lee down? Even after his team lost that big deal, he was able to get them out of their funk and back into the game the next day. Patience. Everyone else that has to work with Margaret is pulling their hair out by the end of the week, but Matthew seems to be able to work with her just fine. How's he do it? Kindness. You know how Carly got that meeting with the buyer? One day she noticed someone trying to get several boxes to their office from the curb, and she stopped to help, and it turned out that's the guy that helped her get the buyer's secretary. Goodness. I know it's legal, but do you think we should set up the deal this way? I thought I'd ask Derek. I trust his sense on these things. Faithfulness. We have a serious problem. If we ask the wrong person to handle it, I'm afraid they might decide to jump ship, but I know I can trust Spencer to see the thing through. Gentleness. If my last boss made a mistake like that, I'd never try and correct him on it. He'd bite my head off. I'm so glad I'm working with Carrie now. So these are the kinds of things that become valuable in the workplace. Hopefully, as I've taken you through it, you sort of see this notion of the fruit of the Spirit. And it's not, I think you can also see, I'm not proposing anything prosperity gospel, like you don't do it so that you can be successful in work, but you do it because those things that make you look like Christ can also be welcomed and can be your brand within the workplace. So at this point, let me stop for a minute and sort of, if you have questions or observations, there's some other stuff to work on, but I've kind of summarized the book for you and what that looks like. So yeah, as an entrepreneur, I realized early on that trust is really kind of the first resource I can get my hands on. And if I build that trust well, it's kind of like it's its own economy. There's sort of this money, you can follow the money, and you can sort of bank it and everything else. With trust, if I gather enough trust, I can basically use it to gain investors, employees, customers, press exposure, strategic partners, sort of everything up and down the line. There's a threshold of trust in almost any decision that you make that's required for you to sort of, go forward within that decision. Right, and so some thresholds are low. Where do you want to eat today? Right? Do I trust you not to take me to this horrible place with the C rating and the health by the health code? trusting somebody to quit your job and come work for them, or trusting somebody to accept their proposal for marriage, I mean, are much, much higher things, right? But there are all these sort of standards where trust is required. And so it turns out that, like money, you can bank trust, you can loan trust, you can look for, you can follow the trust. A lot of times, like with relationships, what I find is normally a relationship that can't correct itself is because somebody's not trusting somebody else as much as you expected them to, or they naturally would. And then you kind of have to say, okay, where do you get that? And sometimes it takes a third party to loan trust into that situation. I had a I hired a young woman to run my tech support, technical support office. The people answer the phones when we have questions. And she had several employees who'd been there for quite a while who were older than her. And there was one woman, Phyllis, that she didn't, they were just like rubbing against each other the whole time. And the manager came and she wanted to get rid of Phyllis. And Phyllis is really competent. And it was kind of one of these situations. What happened was that Phyllis didn't feel like her manager respected her, even though she'd been working there the whole time. She treated her like she was new, so she didn't feel like she was receiving respect, and so she was not providing respect back. And so the manager felt like Phyllis was undermining her authority, and that was the heart of the problem. Because I had developed enough trust between the two of them, I could go to the manager and say, "Do me a favor. Regardless of what your ears hear, I want you to act as if Phyllis respects you, because I've talked to her. I know that she does. What you're getting from her is feedback from a dynamic that needs fixing. But at the heart of it, she knows that you know what you're doing. She's not concerned that you're the wrong person for your job." And just sort of spend the next couple of weeks interacting with her as if she respected you. And I went to Phyllis and I said, "I know you think that she doesn't think you know what you're doing. If she does, it's just she's reacting to things that you're doing. Would you, I'm telling you that she does. Would you act as if she respects you, even if you're not seeing it at the moment?" And by injecting trust into both of them for a little bit of time, I mean, they never joined a bowling team together or anything, but it fixed itself up, right? They were able to work together well and kind of come to that understanding. And so trust is a handy thing to have in all kinds of situations. I served as a board chair for Trinity Academy of Raleigh down the road from here for several years. And have been, I was a part of hiring three different headmasters at the school. By the second time, and hopefully now the third time, I'd gotten it right. But I talked to an awful lot of people who are heads of school who were looking for this job, who they were really competent, good people who knew what they were doing, who to their surprise got handed a box to put their stuff in by the board one day. And it wasn't that there was a particular bad decision that they made. It was that at some point they sort of ran out of enough bank trust. Because being a head of school is a tough job, because every day you deal with situations where you cannot share your side of the story, and the parent desperately wants to share their side of the story to anyone who will listen. Right? And so really architecturally what we did as a school, and the way I had essentially had the board look at themselves, is they're a collector dish of trust towards the head. Because what happens is that if somebody comes to a board member or soccer game or whatever and says, "I heard that Sally had this thing said to her by this teacher, and I think something's wrong." If as a board member you say, and you want to say, that sounds serious, I'll look into it and let you know, because that feels board-like. You have just accelerated that snowball, because the next person they talk to is going to say, "And the board is looking into it," right? And now it's become an even heavier thing. The right thing to do is to say, "I hadn't heard that before, but have you talked to the teacher? I mean, she's really a nice person, and I know you think that she'll be offended, but she's used to being able to handle situations like this. Or have you talked to the head to be able to see it?" And just sort of reassure them. Basically, you never leave the conversation holding the ball. You reassure them on it, and you sort of send them in a direction where you're injecting trust to the person they're going to talk to. And of course, afterwards, you call them and say, "This person's coming, and you got to know they've got this concern." But you never want to be in a situation where you're accelerating that distrust. And so hopefully what happens if the board does their job right is that at any point where your families are, you know, there's sort of some crisis that winds up creating a doubt, that they're able to say, I don't know all the facts, but I know there's a group of people who do know the facts and who I trust to react well to the situation, right? Now that also requires the board to be willing to, you know, look hard at things that may be inconvenient to look hard at, right? They have to earn that trust by taking their job seriously. But if they do it right, they sort of preserve a situation that allows a head to last a long time. So, and I hadn't thought about it much. There's probably a similar dynamic within elder boards and groups like that within churches, that there's, you know, you have similar situations. But you kind of, you know, you sort of look at this and you kind of think about trust as that dynamic. So, you know, when I talk about, I guess to me, from an entrepreneurship standpoint, if trust is the first resource that I have to work with, then the more I can cultivate habits that grow trust, the more it'll be around for me when I need it. And so that means that I'm constantly looking for ways to love people and, you know, and be kind to them where there's opportunity, even if I have no reason to believe it's ever going to do me any good. Right? There's not an agenda to it. I don't just do good to people who I think can help me, but, you know, sort of remembering the days when people might be grieving and let them know they're not alone. Looking out for and connecting people. You know, I thought about you the other day. There's this person that you really ought to know. Can I put you two together? You should have coffee together. Is just habits that I cultivate that lets people know I'm thinking about them even when they're not expecting me to. That creates these resources. So anyway, there's trust. I wrote more about it in the book, as it turns out. Free chapter. What else you want to talk about? Yeah.
How do you?
Thanks for being first, kind of.
Is it on?
I'll repeat the question if it's not, so we'll make it work somehow.
How do you react to expectations? Hmm. You know, whenever people realize I am a Christian, mm-hmm. you know, especially in America, there's a lot of connotation and, you know, things they think a Christian should or shouldn't be. I had a conversation with my manager actually last night, mm-hmm. and I was telling him, like, do you think that I am, you know, being a Christian? He was raised by a pastor and is currently very sour to the idea of Christianity altogether.
Yeah.
We're talking about love, and he's like, you know, loving unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, like, if you claim that, you need to do that. And he was, I mean, which is a fair claim. So how do you think as Christians we should approach expectations in the workplace?
Yeah, so, and it's a good thing. I guess I try to get the demonstration of that brand ahead of whatever I would say when I can. But there's some things that, so I guess in terms of fruit of the Spirit, I can't say that there's been oftentimes where it's like, you know, you ought to be doing this more, you ought to be doing that more if you're this Christian guy. And maybe that's my fault for not, you know, sort of being more vocal around about my faith. I guess I try to find certain windows where I have something surprising to tell them that might break through and break stereotypes. So, for example, I was saying last week I was at the TED conference where TED Talks are born, which is like this 5-day event in Vancouver with CEOs and Google billionaires and, you know, large foundation people and, you know, government officials and everything else. It's kind of rare air in terms of who's there and what they're up to, and it's also an event where Dawkins and Dennett and so the whole tribe has been through to essentially explain. Dawkins once started a TED Talk by saying, "I know this is a highly educated and thoughtful audience, so I know you're all atheists." It's like, gee, thanks, buddy. You know, and then he proceeded to. It's kind of it is another conversation. It's sort of fascinating what he was struggling with, because he was trying to, in the same way that Christians may want to get. Oftentimes you have people who think they're Christian because, you know, they're not Muslim or they're Jewish, they must be Christian, right? But they don't actually understand what that means and know how to live it. He's basically frustrated with agnostics that he wished would act more atheistic. It's like, basically, and you get all the value of being an atheist by being an agnostic, right? By being an atheist, you actually have to work. So, I mean, he's trying to get everyone off the couch. It was kind of funny watching him try to make this thing work. But there's this notion at TED, and for a little while I thought I was the only Christian there, because you had these kinds of things going on. There's this notion, if you're a Christian, you must not be very thoughtful, right? And the other thing, there was one time I was having lunch with a woman, and she's, and at some point I talk about, you know, sort of something involved with faith, or maybe I've written a book or whatever, and her face changed. And I said, "So what? Clearly you're thinking something. I'm safe. What?" She says, why do you guys have such a problem with gay people? And that's, I mean, you know, and that's within our age, that's probably a bigger issue within the workplace in terms of what's being driven culturally. And the thing is, I don't know that she was terribly happy with my answer, but I said, I got a sister who's married to her girlfriend, and they have a couple of kids. I've got my neighbors across the street. We were the first ones to show up, have coffee with them. I think that within the church, the thinking has evolved in thinking in terms of same-sex attraction and being able to draw a line between things. But being able to sort of narrow that space from something where she felt like there was like political opposition to all things, to be able to say, you know, look, it would be, in some ways, it would be convenient if the Bible was silent on it. I don't have an internal need to sort of have this be a fight, but it's not, I can't both say that I'm committed to what the Bible says and take a position that would be convenient for me. That would be abandoning my faith. You know, it's inconvenient, darn it. I don't want you to make that face to me. But my alternative is to break with what I've decided and committed to be true. And I think that she could respect that. There's another woman the other day who, this past week, she was born in Russia. She was first arrested by the KGB at 6 months old. Wound up going to the Bolshoi, eventually finding her way to America, where she got PhDs in physics and biology, I think, while putting two kids through Yale. And she's like 80 years old. Her son is a Google billionaire or something like that. And we were talking, and she talked about sort of what are you going to do next. And I sort of almost a throwaway line said, well, I guess whatever God has for me. And her head snaps around. She's, are you religious? It's like, well, very much so. Are you? And she takes this face and she says, I could never forgive God for what he's, you know, for the things that's happened in my life. And you know, and the thing is, I was able at that point, I was able, you know, she's a physicist, and I said, okay, let me. I felt like the challenge there was to be somebody who was thoughtful enough to be able to respond to that question. I said, okay, so let me ask you a couple questions. So if there is a God, let's posit that he's all powerful and that he's good. And he didn't have to create everything, right? He could, at the point that he was going to say, let there be light, he could have looked all the way down to the end of it, seen what the conclusion was, and said, nah, it's not worth it, right? And in fact, if he's good, he would have not done it. And she's like, okay, I follow you. And he's also knowing enough to know that to the extent that there was going to be evil and pain in the world, that he could start the ball rolling in the way there was the least possible evil and pain in the world to accomplish the good end that must have made it worth it. So as hard as this world is, I think that it's, I think that if you start with God, you have to understand that there has to be something worth it, and there's no more pain than had to be allowed for something to go on. And she says, and she sort of nods, because now she's, okay, I'm sort of talking in terms of infinities and everything. She's sort of picking up on it. And so let me ask you something else. So you have a God, he can make anything he wants, right? Create anything he wants. What would be precious to someone like that? And she thinks for a minute. She says, I don't know. Said, his son's blood. The thing is that, and Jesus was with God at the time that let there be light was said. They, you know, this is something that they did together, and they knew that saying that was going to cost him the most precious thing in the world to him. So this isn't just sort of something for entertainment. He didn't have Netflix, so he decided to start the world or something. This had to be something that was so important that it was worth the most precious thing in the universe to be able to do. And that he did that, you know, clearly he must have done that so that you would be, you know, so that he could have a relationship with you. And she kind of had a sober look. She says, I've never thought about that before. I'll give some thinking to that. So sometimes it's, I guess for me, I try to be able to have answers and questions worthy of where somebody is, for them to be able to think of somebody as thoughtful and not just sort of programmed in. But that's kind of the space I operate in. What else do you want to talk about? I don't.
Additional questions? While we're here.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, my name is Joseph. I really appreciate the observation you started out with. Basically, just even sharing personally this, I think you said spiritual amnesia.
Yeah, yeah.
What I believe on Sunday, yeah. I tend to forget Monday through Saturday.
Yeah.
It's very true for many believers, people who have the indwelling of the Spirit or called to live out the fruits of the Spirit, and then it's not happening. And that's, I'm a pastor, and that's scary how easy that is in the church as well. I guess the question I have is, what do you think contributes to that forgetfulness? If you had to say what creates that separation from the core beliefs, things that cognitively I know, I want, maybe even want to live out, but now Monday through Saturday or throughout the rest of the week, it's very easy for me to not prioritize living out the fruits of the Spirit.
That's a great question. I think a lot about identity. I think that a lot of life is this sort of journey of both the deciding who you are and realizing who you are, right? The Christian walk is largely sort of surrendering control of identity. And it is, everything else in the world is literally screaming for you to move in the other direction, right? That how special you are, how important you are, how popular you are, how successful you are, how influential you are, comes down to your identity, right? Even more, I mean, right, you know, people, at this point, it's come down to brute force. How many likes did I get? Who retweeted this thing, right? How many followers do I have on social media? I mean, it's really kind of devolved into, you know, sort of Duplo blocks of identity. You know, it's not even nuanced at all at this point. And so all those things, and the same is true with me, right? There's several facets to who I am. I mean, I'm a follower of Christ, but I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm a business leader. I'm an author. I'm a mentor to a number of people, and each one of those things, I wind up thinking about how am I cultivating that? How do those things shape me, and how do I consciously shape them back when I can? But I think that it's I think that there's always pressure. I don't think you sort of ever get up a hill where it's like, okay, now it's clear. There's sort of always this. This force that wants you to pay attention to the rest of your identity. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that I can segue to. I mean, So, you know, one of the other things that I guess as pastors to think about. So, if I'm going to be real transparent, where does this audio go? By the way,
it goes online.
Okay. So I have a friend, and this friend sold his internet company when he was fairly young, and his job as provider of his family was over from that point. And there's a kind of wealth that becomes part of identity, right? You know, it's sort of, you know, some people know they've got a slick jump shot. Other people know they're wealthy, and it's just they carry it around with them as sort of something that they know, right? And you will have people that in your churches that are like that. And they don't even necessarily, it's not a matter of how much money you have. It's whether as your identity, the thing that maybe the thing that makes you special, makes you worth being listened to, is that you have money, right? And so there's, I mean, first of all, there's another war of attrition, right? When this happened to my friend, he had to figure out how did he own his money and not his money own him, right? How was it not the thing that essentially defined him, but really was just another facet of who he was, like being a dad and being a husband and being a leader. And I think that, you know, for people in that situation, there's not a lot of resources for them to go to. You know, and I think that in some ways they're more open to and interested in talking than you might think. I think that generally, when the subject of wealth comes in within the church, it's largely, like on the pie chart, it's probably 90% generosity conversations, right? But the thing is that there's, how do you, I got a friend of mine who, this is a different friend of mine that's not named Chris, but his wife, he had an infidelity, his wife divorced him, and it turned out that he had so much money that there was no good reason for her to stick around in a family. It's enough money that anything that sort of bothered her, she could go off and live very well with whoever she wanted to for as long as she liked. And so there was sort of no safety net binding that relationship together, right? And one of the things that I took away from it is that within my marriage, and my friend took away from it within his marriage, is that you kind of had to proof your marriage, sort of make sure that you never gave an opportunity or a window for something to happen, that there was mutual reliance. There's questions about how do you walk by faith? How do you say, give us this day our daily bread, when you've got a lifetime of bread stored up in the closet? And that's true of a lot of Americans, for that matter, right? How do you engineer your life so that it's a life where you are dependent upon God to do the things you're called to do? I mean, what has led me to do is to sort of take on projects that are bigger than I have the ability to, than I know I can do, right? There's some things I could do where it's like, yeah, I there's no risk in doing this. I'm sure I can make this work out. But projects of faith are ones where you take on where it's like, if God's not in it, it's not going to happen. And if other people don't see this as well, it's not going to happen. And so there's a lot of facets to this, if you think about it and put yourself in someone's shoes, that they could use your thinking on.
We have time for one more question, Dr. Face.
Yeah.
Hold on just a second. Get the microphone to us.
Okay.
Don't mind, that way it's being recorded.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for everything you shared.
Yeah.
Just as a pastor and someone who trains pastors and been in a lot of churches and see some detachment from those in pastoral ministry and those in the pew, and that distance mm-hmm. happens in a lot of different levels yeah. and a lot of different ways. And one of the greatest areas of distance seems to be understanding mm-hmm. the workplace world, yeah. whether that's because a pastor never really had a vocation outside of vocational mm-hmm. ministry, or it's been so long, or just unawareness, whatever it may be. And so my question specifically is, what are some of the mischaracterizations that pastors have in their minds mm. as it relates to their people that can inform their preaching and help it be more applicational towards the end that you're reaching out for in your book through their pulpit ministry? If that, yeah. that makes sense.
It does. I mean, the hard thing is that I'm on the other side of the chasm in the workplace. I don't know what it's like inside your head as a pastor, right? But I think what you can do, though, is
probably sat through enough sermons though and felt like, dude, you have no idea.
Well,
what
but I mean,
like.
They don't talk about the workplace at all, though.
That's
mostly,
what I mean. Yeah.
It's not that they're mischaracterizing it; it's that they're not characterizing it,
okay.
right? So I think that the way you solve that is take some business people to lunch and tell me what do you do? And here, here's your five magic words, right? What do you do? They answer the question. That sounds like hard work. That sounds hard. They will tell you what makes it hard and what's difficult about it, right? And that's how you'll hear, right? And that's, you'll hear it from the people who are within your space. I mean, if you're in a textile town, it may be different than if you're in a medical town or a tourist town or anything else in terms of what makes it hard. But it will, they'll tell you their stories if you ask them, I think.